This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, an independent report about Wells Fargo says the practice of creating bogus accounts goes back to at least 2002. The homicide rate rises again this week in Charlotte. The Police Foundation of Washington, D.C. continues its evaluation of CMPD with a public meeting. Two Republican lawmakers make news. One introduces a bill in the North Carolina House that would ban same-sex marriage despite federal rulings. The other would expand Medicaid. And Patrick Cannon gets his own radio show. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and they are Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner, a reporter for WBTV News. Welcome to you all. Welcome back.
Morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, or you can get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. So, the Wells Fargo Board of Directors announced a clawback this week of an additional $75 million in compensation from two executives over the bogus customer account scandal. An independent report shows that the practice of creating these accounts to meet employee compensation bonuses may go back as far as 2002. Is this the last shoe to drop in this internal investigation, or is there more to come?
Well, Steven Sanger, who's Wells' new CEO, says there are no more shoes to drop. I don't think that's right. And I actually think that the fair thing to point out here is the headline is really what you said out of this report. And it's 110 pages of a fascinating read, at times scathing, at times it's going to leave either Wells' employees, rank-and-file employees, or banking, you know, watchdog groups steaming. The reality of it is I want to do one slight correction. It says in the report that this practice of creating fraudulent accounts, and they are fraudulent, these dummy accounts to boost sales numbers, goes back to at least 2002. It may actually go back further.
Yeah.
And most of that time early on, this was all centered out west in states like Colorado, Arizona, and Los Angeles, specifically Los Angeles and California.
And if it goes back to 2002, that's prior to their takeover of Wachovia. So it's the Wachovia end of this is clean.
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
That's exactly right. And what's also interesting is it may go back as far as the 90s when Wells Fargo merged with Norwest, which is another bank chain. And really what happened here is it's a basic principle for retail, whether it's bank or whether it's a store or a grocery store. Everybody loves to see this year-over-year number, sales boosted year-over-year at the same location. It's a sign in the stock market that your company and your business plan is making money and it's growing, and that in turn boosts your stock price, which is obviously key for a publicly traded company, especially a large bank. And what happened here is they started to set these unrealistic numbers, these really hard-to-reach numbers. And the report even states they called it a 50-50 plan. 50% of these branches in the country were not supposed to be able to hit these numbers. But everybody started hitting these numbers. And then the next year, you would have the prior year's goal plus some. And then the following year, the pattern would repeat. So you keep getting this incremental but significant increase in the amount of pressure on your bank tellers, on your branch workers,
right,
to hit these numbers. And there is a practice basically of, you know, they love to have these bundled things where you try to sell seven products to a customer. And if you couldn't sell them to the customer, it's pretty clear now. And the report points it right out that they knew this was going on, but they kind of downplayed it. They being the management, not necessarily the board, that they started opening these accounts again and again and again and again in customers' names. Sometimes the employees, when they set them up, would use their own money to put into the account to make it look like it had been activated by an actual consumer, and then they would take their own money out. So that way they would get these, you know, these pay bonuses based on performance.
Yeah.
I think the report tells us, and the report was commissioned by the board of directors, that they would very much like to say that this is pretty much wrapped up. You know, we messed up really big, but we've targeted the executives who did this. You know, we've gotten them out, although I think it's 10 executives altogether who, mm-hmm, in some way, shape, or form have left, not always fired. And so, gosh, guys, we're really sorry, but it's over. But I think Tom's right. It's this, the repercussions are not done at all. There is still a Justice Department investigation going on. There are shareholders who are saying that these directors themselves ought to be held more accountable. So when they have their shareholders meeting, they ought to be voted out. And just in this morning's paper, we were reporting that there are more job cuts coming at Wells Fargo, in part because of the expenses of this. They spent, I think they said, $80 million in the first quarter related to legal costs, investigations, still dealing with the aftermath of this, and that these costs may go on. So, again, what we've seen is that more than 5,000 rank-and-file people lost their jobs as this came to light. More, presumably, rank-and-file people are going to lose their jobs, not because they did anything wrong, but because this is expensive.
5,300 rank-and-file
5,300, yes, sorry.
I'm just pointing that out because it needs to be underlined. While 10 executives lost their jobs, 5,300 rank-and-file
employees. I said 1,000.
Go ahead.
What has not gotten a lot of press coverage in this is the underlying motivations. We talk about wanting to drive the stock price, but stock price informs executive compensation. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a ton of money. I think in total they have clawed back, and I love that phrase. they've clawed back what 130 some million?
180 million.
$180 million. That's a ton of money. The higher that stock price goes, the more executives earn. And so there's this inherent conflict of interest to push that stock price higher, even if it means engaging in questionable practices. And I think until we can, as a nation and as a government and as regulatory agencies, I think until we can address that, we're going to continue to see that. We saw this during the subprime loan crisis that led to the Great Recession. It keeps happening because there is an inherent reason for it.
Hmm. The Justice Department is looking into this. White-collar crime usually does not get punished very severely. Could this be considered white-collar crime, particularly if John Stumpf, the head of the company at the time, knew about this and did nothing to stop it?
Well, and the report actually says that he did know something about it, but that he was unwilling or unable to step in to either change the practice or to stop the practice.
Is unable even possible? He's the head of the company.
That's the exact right question to ask, Mike. And that's what the report stated.
And they've really pointed the finger at Carrie Tolstedt, who was the person who was in charge. And
she took early retirement, is that correct?
I believe she was actually fired for cause, wasn't she?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, you're right. She was fired for cause.
If she's sending the message below, you must meet these numbers, don't tell me how, but do it. And meanwhile, she's telling him, we're great, look at these numbers. The question becomes, did he ask enough questions?
Tom. Well, and the key thing here, too, is this is a financial crime with one of the largest banks in the world. The odds of this being settled in some form with a fine, just like the $185 million they have already paid, is likely. However, if there is one person in particular this report goes to stress the blame on, it's Carrie Tolstedt. And what's interesting, too, is it goes so far to say that she deliberately held back from alerting the board to exactly how deep this problem went. And when she was confronted with it, she refused to see it as the cause, the financial bonus structure, the pay structure, that she refused to see it as the cause of the problem. However, what's interesting, though, is the bank has had internal reports from years before this went public. And frankly, the bank hasn't done a whole lot until the Los Angeles Times started reporting on this. They knew in the early 2000s that this was a potential problem. Their own audit branch flagged this as a risk for the bank. How high up that went, we don't really know. Mm. But if the board is not aware of an internal audit pointing this out, that is in part on the board.
Nick.
Well, the interesting dynamic when you talk about the Department of Justice investigation is, we had an Obama administration that was, I think it's fair to say, rather bank-friendly. I mean, you had Attorney General Eric Holder, who worked before he was Attorney General and has worked after Attorney General defending big banks. And we saw lots of criticism of the Eric Holder Justice Department for being friendly and soft on banks and entering into these favorable settlements. Well, you have the Trump administration now, and if I'm Donald Trump and I'm looking to shed some of my Wall Street friendly cred and kind of appeal to the everyman like I have, maybe coming down hard on Wells Fargo for
but
this.
But everybody in the cabinet's from Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, but they're not from Wells Fargo. And Jeff Sessions is, you know, from Alabama with no Wall Street.
True.
But I'm just saying this could be a politically, you know, maybe Wells Fargo wanted to have done this 2 years ago under the Obama administration. And, you know, this could be a very politically expedient target to seek out.
I think but you still have the Trump administration talking about loosening regulations on Wall Street,
sure,
on banks,
sure,
and getting back to the formula that basically was instilled, frankly, by President Bill Clinton that allowed a lot of these things to happen.
So how do these clawbacks work when they talk about getting money back from these executives who profited from things that were not real? Are they saying write us a check for $108 million, or are they saying this compensation that we promised you in the out years, 2020, 2025, is not coming your way?
It's a mix. With the CEO, with the former CEO, it's actually they're taking money away from a retirement fund that he has, which is deferred compensation. And a lot of times with executives and C-suite executives, you end up with these deferred compensations. It's a combination of that. They don't have the legal right to necessarily demand a check back, but they can withhold from other benefits.
You reported this week on this, Tom, and you said that this independent 110-page report is scathing, filled with words like unrealistic, systemic, and resisted and impeded scrutiny or oversight. How does that jibe with what the independent evaluators called a corporate culture that seemed to encourage running the bank like you own it? I mean, if I'm running the bank like I own it, it's going to be honest.
And that is a friendly mantra that employees at Wells Fargo know well. Run it like you own it. And it's supposed to encourage you to do exactly what you just described. But realistically, what was behind that mantra was a surprisingly decentralized form, you know, structure from a major multinational corporation, in essence. That take HR. You always think of human resources as being this group inside, you know, the corporate offices. HR departments were actually spread out for divisions. So each division had their own HR office. They had, you know, it was a completely decentralized model. In addition to that, you basically had these kind of regional fiefdoms with directors in certain places that could then dictate down to all the way down to the, you know, the bank managers and the tellers their own policies, which is why early on, as I said, you notice these practices were really flaring in Arizona, in Colorado, and in Los Angeles, because those directors were the people who were really pushing this. That decentralized model now is actually something that Wells Fargo said this week, that they are actually going to start changing, trying to re-centralize things. They're calling it efficiencies, but if you look at that, they seem to be trying to pull in to more of a centralized culture.
The Committee for Better Banks, which is a coalition of bank workers, community, and community advocacy groups, says this really shows that Wells Fargo is still putting a significant amount of blame on frontline bank workers, the fact that they fired 5,300 people, they've only identified 10 high echelon executives and got rid of them. Will comments like that cause the management of the bank or the directors of the bank to look more deeply at their management to see if further punishments need to be meted out? And given the fact that their board of directors is about to meet and some shareholders have called for 12 of the 15 members of the board to be voted out, will they be taking a more serious look at this?
I think it all matters on what happens April 25th, which is exactly when the shareholder meeting will take place. And it's not just shareholders who are calling for the board to be, you know, 12 members of the board to be voted out. It's one of the most influential investment analyst firms that's calling for 12 of the 15 to go.
When we come back, we'll talk about the Charlotte homicide rate continuing to rise and look at some of the goings-on in the State House this week. They are busy, busy, busy up there. They can't get enough. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Telware, servicing the Carolinas with unified voice, data, and video solutions since 1984, now offering hosted solutions for small businesses. More info at telware.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's Skyline Run, a 5K race and family fun event that supports student needs. Saturday, April 22nd, details at cpccfoundation.org/skyline. This city of trees finds itself at a tipping point. Rather than growing the tree canopy to cover 50% of the city by 2050, we are now on track for the canopy to shrink. And here's a shocker. Tree-lined Myers Park could lose nearly 60% of its trees between now and 2050. Development, the age of trees, those are the two biggest problems here. And we speak to the city's chief arborist and others about possible solutions on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, Tillerson face-to-face with Putin, Sean Spicer's Hitler blunder, turbulent times for United Airlines. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The look back at the week's news continues with On Point after the Charlotte Talks local news roundup at 10, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Nick Oxner is here from WBTV News. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. And Tom Bullock from WFAE News. At this time last year, Charlotte CMPD reported 12 homicides. As of today, if it hasn't changed overnight, the number for this year stands at 28. Is there a pattern to who the shooters and the victims are and where these murders have occurred?
Well, they do seem to be, you know, in a sort of a crescent around the north, northeast part of Charlotte. There's not a clear-cut pattern in terms of at least what police are saying, that, you know, that there's gang activity. This is not the Crips and the Bloods, you know, gunning each other down in the streets. The individual cases, we actually talked last week a little bit about the troubling trend of teens as victims and as perpetrators. And I think we even mentioned that the first homicide of the year had been this 14-year-old young man, police officer's son. No obvious sign of why this would have happened, shot down outside a relative's house. And this week they did arrest two additional teenagers. And everybody involved is black males, as I think has been the majority of the victims in these cases. And
some Hispanics. But,
yeah, and again, it's just puzzling. They say there is no sign of any connection between the victim and the two shooters. I didn't cover this. I was reading the article, and it was a little hard to figure out, but it almost sounded, at one point they were talking about whether they knew somebody had been shot and killed, but at a certain point they should have known. One of them is charged with actually doing the shooting and the other with accessory after the fact. So it kind of sounds like they may have just sort of randomly shot at this house. It's tragic to
and
see
w,
these things happen.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Nick.
Well, I was going to say there is one common theme is that they're generally all young people. The victims are mostly young. And they all seem to kind of be things that situations where a disagreement escalated or they're random. But none of them seem to be you kind of classic crime, murders, gangs, drug deals gone bad. And I think that's what has been so puzzling to the police about this spike in crime is because they can't figure out how to get to the root of the problem.
The WFAE is tracking these homicides on our website at WFAE.org. And it's pretty impressive the way this works. When you go to the website and look at how this happens, you can learn a lot about. There's a timeline. You click on the timeline. You can find out about the victims in each of those incidents. Does there seem to be a pattern as to why these people are being murdered? There's no way to figure it out?
No. I think it's important to give CMPD credit. They're out there on this. I mean, you have Chief Kerr Putney saying, we're going to the hotspots. We're trying to have more of a presence. If this was so identifiable as crime murder spikes that we've seen in the past in other cities, going back to gang violence or drug violence, then they're doing the thing to stop it. But since this does not seem to be that, at least not right now, that's why this trend continues. And it is troubling.
And it is good to pay attention because for those of us who go back to, I don't remember the years, but when Henry Louis Wallace, the serial killer in Charlotte, there was a string of deaths piling up, and these were people who were living kind of on the margins, and you would have a woman found dead here or there, and there didn't seem to be this awareness until the police actually caught on to him, and suddenly it was like, okay, what was it, 9 or 10 of these deaths were all being done by a serial killer in Charlotte, and he was one of the nation's first black serial killers, so it was... It's good for people to look for patterns, even if they're not finding one.
And we've had the chief on here. We've had the former chief of police on here talking about this. We've done several programs on this topic about the increase in the murder rate, not just here but around the country. And when WFAE's David Borax attended the Youth Violence Prevention Program on Friday, the blame was placed in the same place that we've talked about on this program, on the ready and increasing availability of guns, a willingness to use those guns to resolve conflict, the lack of mental health services in the community, racism, the resegregation of our schools, lack of economic opportunities. Does all this sound familiar? The normalization of violence. We've known all this for a really long time, and there doesn't seem to be much traction on solving any of it.
And I think you raised the right point. We've known all of this for a really long time. And I don't think guns are any more available this year than they were last mm-hmm. year. So even if you put all of those things together, they don't adequately explain this jump, not just in Charlotte, as you pointed out, but nationally. And not just in homicides, but we're seeing an increase in violent crime, period. Mm-hmm. And what's curious about this, we talked about this a little last week, is that during the Great Recession, when people were truly unemployed and truly perhaps financially desperate, we actually saw a decrease in violent crime. We saw a decrease in homicides. And now that things are improving, those numbers are going in the opposite
direction.
Could
that be because when we were in the Great Recession, almost everybody except the really 1%, everybody was suffering? Now there's a recovery and people are back to work and the economy is improving and you can buy stuff, but not for everybody. Not everybody has benefited. And well, so they see all this going on and where's mine?
Well, that's certainly one theory. It would be counterintuitive. Typically speaking, I think history has shown that during tougher economic times, we tend to see a rise more in the crime rate. Which as I said, is what's really puzzling now. Why now?
Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I don't have stats to back this up, but we seem to be seeing more homicides with younger people now. Homicides have always been primarily young people, young males, unfortunately young African-American males disproportionately. But this time, we're actually seeing a lot of these that are very young.
How much of it comes down to respect? If you feel disrespected, and you live in a culture of violence, it's all over television, it's all over the movies, it's in video games, it's in your neighborhood, it's in your community. If you've been disrespected and you have access to a gun, by God, I'm going to use it.
I think that is part of that culture. I can't deny that. But once again, what has changed since last year? What has changed since the year before
exactly.
last? That culture of respect or that culture of not tolerating disrespect has been there for a long time. So I don't think even that can explain this year's rise.
Okay. Yesterday, it was announced that Scott Broyles, who is the interim dean of the Charlotte School of Law, had stepped down. When he was on this program last week, he made it clear that he didn't like the way the school had been run previously and that upon taking the position, he had more control over admission standards, which is what had gotten the school in trouble in the first place, with the American Bar Association, who put them on probation last fall, and then with the Department of Education, who in December stopped funding student loans. This sounds like a mammoth job, so I asked him about that. You're the interim dean.
Correct.
Do you want the job?
Whew, it's been 2.5 weeks. It's been a pretty tough time. I want the job as long as I can help the school get back to where it needs to be, a responsible, sound academic institution.
That was last week, and yesterday he told the media it was basically a situation where if I can't do something positive, then there's no particular reason for me to stay in this position. It was very, very frustrating to see the students' financial situation decline daily without federal funds and my inability to move the needle in that regard. Today, in the Charlotte Observer, it was further reported that some of his comments were so out there, so honest, that school didn't like it very much. Which played the greater role in this resignation, do you think, Anne?
I don't know. I mean, 3.5 weeks is not very long to give it a shot. I mean, clearly he felt extremely frustrated. He was having trouble getting the loans from the education department. I think there was some thought that perhaps with the change in administration that there might be some movement on that. You have students. I think they said there were about 220 left. 110 of them will graduate in May, probably with somewhat tarnished degrees. The other 110, it's really hard to imagine that this school is going to keep going much longer.
Right.
I mean, it's just, well, what do you do after this?
Note,
he was the big hope.
Yeah, and note that Ann did not bring up new students coming in because they are not accepting new students. Right. So it's one thing to change the academic standards to enter the Charlotte School of Law, but it's a rather symbolic gesture when they are not enrolling new students because really they can't.
Well, and I take Scott Broyles' comments to be, look, I got here. I thought we could change some of our policies that the Department of Education didn't like so we could get the money to fund new students and our current students. And if you read more, you know, I take more to your point about his comments rankling some of the administrators higher up. Because remember, he works for a for-profit company, just like no different than Wells Fargo. Yeah, no different than Wells Fargo, right? That's motivated by profits because that's what a for-profit company does. And so I he's been pretty open, one, about the company's problems, and two, about the fact now that his bosses didn't like that, didn't like his comments. And so, yeah, I think he got in, took a look around, and he comes from, you know, he's a former federal prosecutor. He comes
He's a fighter.
Right, and with good credentials, too, and with his integrity and reputation intact.
So well, that raises the question about Infolaw, which is, I mean, they have trouble at others of their schools around the country. They have one in Arizona. They have one in
Florida.
In Florida. And if they don't, if this guy is the last great hope of the Charlotte School of Law, formerly the largest law school in the state, and he's saying, clean up your act, and they're not listening, they're doomed, don't you think?
But they're, maybe they're going to keep making a profit.
Well, there another school
How?
Is about—
if you don't have any students.
Well, with the other two schools, they still have students, but another one of the schools is—
having troubles.
Is about to— they're looking at probation as well, which means they could suffer the exact same fate as Charlotte School of Law. And I honestly think what Broyles gets down to, I agree. I don't think this was about just the financial fate of federal loans. I guarantee you that's part of it. I take him at his word on that. But 3.5 weeks is not a long time to deal with a bureaucratic argument and also getting off of probation. I think it does have more to do with Infolaw and exactly what he would be freed up to do and not freed up to do. And I'm guessing here, this is just my opinion, but it seems like what he saw a lay of the land and it was not a friendly one.
And it sure does seem like it would be a bad investment now to sign up for any Infolaw school. I mean, even though I know that's not the name on it, I know they have their own little names. There's an internet out there, and if you're going to law school, you ought to be doing a little bit.
Yes, yeah, exactly right.
You ought to know that, you know, that this is run by the same company that has had these horrendous problems in Charlotte, and that maybe the school you were looking at paying $40,000 tuition to might not be solvent.
So as you pointed out, he was considered by students and many in the faculty to be the last great hope for the survival of the Charlotte School of Law. Now that he has resigned, he's intending to stay on as an instructor or as a professor of law. Who will take over?
Do we know that?
The president has been mum on that so far. I mean, it is so— – it sounds like he just kind of, you know, packed his boxes and walked out. Like you say, just a few days earlier, he was on your show talking as if he was staying. It's got to be a close out the business model at this point.
Okay. Former Republican Governor Pat McCrory said this many times, including on this program, that the state could not afford to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare Act, because the program was already a mess in North Carolina and facing serious cost overruns, and because the federal dollars that would be coming in to support the expansion of Medicare, at least in the short term, would sunset at some point, and the state did not know what those costs would eventually be or how they would be able to fund them. So they didn't expand Medicare, which caused a lot of people to fall in this donut hole under Obamacare, where they could not get Obamacare and they couldn't get Medicaid. Excuse me, expansion of Medicaid, not Medicare. They couldn't get it either. So that's why Obamacare doesn't work so well in this state for a lot of people. Now, a Republican legislator has proposed expanding Medicaid. So what's changed?
Oh, no, he's not. Don't say Medicaid expansion. Say Carolina Cares.
Exactly
because,
right.
Because that's a big part of this, is I think the Republicans were extraordinarily successful at convincing their people that Obamacare is horrible. Mm-hmm. Even as— – and I—
– they're still saying it. Robert Pittenger said it this week.
Spent a year so focused on this. And people who desperately needed medical insurance and sometimes were getting it with the Obamacare subsidies were still, you know, Obama's bad, this program is bad. So I think what he's saying is let's be careful how we phrase this, but it would be really nice to provide medical insurance for working poor people.
Tom.
And I want to say, let's name him, because that's an interesting twist in this whole story. It's Representative Donnie Lambeth. this is not just your average, you know, random Republican representative in the state house. He's a heavy hitter with the Republican caucus. He is a former head of a hospital. He is head of the health committee, head of the health care reform committee. And for him to be the one that's behind this is absolutely a twist to the story. So it is not just here we go again.
This is a recognition by Republicans in Raleigh that they have many of their constituents who are working, should have health insurance, should be able to afford to pay for that health insurance, and yet they can't. And so I don't know that this Medicaid expansion is actually going to pass this session, but I think this is the start of Republicans realizing, hey, we actually need to do something, and we need to actually stop what we've been saying for years. We need to find a way to gracefully back out of that.
Yes, because suddenly Obamacare is popular. It's popular.
Health insurance is popular, and people realize that Obamacare equals health insurance.
And Obama's not around to blame anymore.
That's right.
Right. And actually, I think it points to two things. One, how political Obamacare was to begin with. Mm-hmm. This was as much about the man as it was about the program. The other thing is that some type of repeal and replace effort is still lingering out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And under some scenarios, states that have expanded Medicaid may actually fare better under some scenarios than states that did not.
Under the Republican proposal.
Exactly. So what we're seeing, not just in North Carolina, but some other Republican-controlled states as well, we're seeing lawmakers starting to reconsider.
So there is a difference in Donnie Lambert's proposal, probably even from the one that Governor Cooper proposed and tried to do it through executive action, and the legislature shot it down. Carolina Cares is for residents between 19 years of age and 64. Mm-hmm. It says you must have skin in the game, meaning that you will pay premiums based on your income and ability to pay.
And a copay.
Yes, and copays. You must have a job or be trying to get a job, and you have to get regular checkups, make regular trips to the dentist, get colonoscopies at the proper intervals, have mammograms, and take part in weight management programs. This is a new one. Is this something that most people who currently have no access to health care want to do?
I think this sort of goes to the mindset.
Get a checkup.
That part of the Republican pitch has been that Obamacare and many of these social programs are a giveaway to freeloaders, just to be really crass about it, the way it's pitched, that some people don't really deserve health care. And so this is sort of putting some of these things in place to say, well, these are deserving people, or we're going to make sure they are, that they're doing all the right things. And that has always been part of it, is that, yes, some health care costs are driven by people who make bad decisions about their own health. I don't think that's limited to poor people. I think almost all of us, if we think at some point, you know, we've done something, we've skipped some preventive care, we've, you know, not eaten or exercised as well as we should have. So this is, I guess, the constructive approach would be that they're trying to ensure that everybody does these things.
There's another side to this, too, I want to bring up, and I think it gets to the core argument. The big thing that Republicans in Raleigh could always point to is unexpected costs. Now, Obamacare is still the law of the land. Through 2020, you know, the government's going to pay 90%. Preventative health care, this is a cost-proven way to bring those costs down, to help control costs. This is coming from, again, the head of a hospital. He is using this in order to control costs.
And there's one more element of this I want to talk about when we come back, and then we'll move on to some other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Jazz Arts Initiative. Vocalist Sasha Mazakowski performs a tribute to Antonio Carlos Jobim and the Music of Brazil this Friday and Saturday at the Blumenthal Stage Door Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. The Afghan Bomb, Tillerson Face to Face with Putin, Sean Spicer's Hitler Blunder. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about as the weekly news roundup, national and international hour, continues with On Point and Tom Ashbrook at the top of the hour. If you'd like to talk to us or reach us or have a comment about some of the stories in our news, you can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. We're coming right back.
Hey, y'all. It's Sam Sanders. I am a big Twitter guy. Sometimes I find myself thinking in hashtags, like hashtag he made that up or hashtag Inskeep comb over. But one real hashtag I am digging these days is cars into programs. That means when you donate your old car to the station, they can turn it into the programs you love. Hashtag pretty awesome.
Look for the WFAE vehicle donation link under the support tab at WFAE.org for more details.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Ann Doss Helms with the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. The other difference in Carolina Cares than in perhaps in some previous programs, and certainly in Obamacare, is that while the federal government will cover 90% of the cost of expanding Medicaid under this proposal, the remaining 10% would be funded through assessments, including but not limited to hospitals. What has been the reaction to that?
Well, it mirrors the when Governor Roy Cooper, and you alluded to a little earlier, that tried to expand Medicaid kind of unilaterally right when he became governor. That's roughly how he wanted to fund his program, through by having hospitals pick up a portion of the bill. And I think that's interesting because, you know, Cooper had appointed Dr. Mandy Cohen to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state. She came from Washington, where she was a big wig in the Obama administration, the health care and the Department
CMS.
Of Health. Yeah, at CMS. The agency that administers Medicare and Medicaid. And I think that when Cooper appointed Cohen to this position in North Carolina, Republicans in the General Assembly thought this is going to be Cooper going to try to ram through his extremist liberal Medicaid expansion, blah, blah, blah. And what they found instead, from what I understand and what I've been told from folks in Raleigh, is that they found Mandy Cohen to be someone who's willing to work with Republicans, who actually knows what she's talking about, has ideas that are actually productive and can reform our system. And so I think what you're going to start to see a little bit is some bipartisan coming together on things, exactly like Republicans proposing a thing that looks something like what Roy Cooper proposed. And I think we're going to start to see getting to a common place here on this issue of how we cover health expenses for people.
Glenn. I want to go back very quickly to the proposed restrictions on who would qualify for Medicaid. One of the things that we're going to see when we get back around to replace and repeal Obamacare, and we will get back around to it at some point, is that states are going to have much more control over who qualifies. And I guess the cynic in me wonders if this is a way for the Republicans in North Carolina to kind of have it both ways. They can say, we did expand Medicaid. But at the same time, we put these restrictions on it, and actually, in reality, far fewer people are going to qualify than they would if under the current system. So it's kind of a way to have it both ways.
What's the chance of this bill passing?
Well, the key is going to be in the Senate, and the Senate is the far more conservative chamber in the General Assembly, and it's dominated by rural Republicans. And Representative Lambeth knows this. He knows what the odds are, and right now, they are slim, but in order to – he did this really interesting tactical move at the press conference he had to roll this out, which was he had Alex Hitt, who is a farmer from a rural area of the state, come out and say this is a jobs program. Now, this is something you've already heard before from people like Governor Roy Cooper, but the way that Hitt described it is something that was interesting. He said that the vast majority of farms that go out of business do not do so because of crop failure, because of natural disaster, or because of cheap food imports. Mm-hmm. They do so because a family member gets sick and they can't afford the premiums or the health care coverage or whatever the case is. But that health emergency becomes a bankruptcy, and that bankruptcy effectively ends that farm.
Is it wise to be proposing legislation about health care in any state at this point until they figure out in Washington what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think this is, like we said earlier, trying to get ahead of what they decide in Washington. And the tea leaves on what road it's going to go down in Washington are well and apparent at this point. But back to Tom's point about does this pass or not, I'm not sure this session it even gets through the House. I think we're going
to – It's coming late in the season for sure.
And I don't think there's the will there to get this done this session. I just don't think so. But I think maybe next session we'll see something. And this will increasingly be a big – big elephant in the room that we need to tackle. And so I think not this session, I think probably next
So session. There was another House bill filed on Tuesday that by Wednesday seemed dead in the water.
It was dead when it was filed on Tuesday.
It was dead before that, as it was written.
Well, let's clear up the mystery here. That bill was filed by four House Republicans, and it would direct state government to defy the U.S. Supreme Court and restore the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. The House Speaker, Tim Moore, said he would not allow the bill to go through the House because he had severe, quote, constitutional concerns. Did those who filed this bill think that they had a shot at this, or were they simply making a statement?
No, people always think that bills that are filed are actually intended to become law. Mm-hmm. No. A lot of times it's intended to play to your base. It's intended to for you to be able to go to a town hall somewhere and say, hey, look what I tried to do, but others just would not support me.
So one of the sponsors of that bill, Nick, was Republican Larry Pittman of Concord, who also this week, and he's in Time magazine today for this.
Yes. North Carolina just cannot get out of that spotlight, can we? We just keep jumping back in.
Anyway, Larry Pittman of Concord called Abraham Lincoln, quote, the same sort of tyrant as Adolf Hitler. Social media strikes again because he made that comment on Facebook in response to a comment criticizing the same-sex marriage nullification bill that he had filed. And he asked on Facebook, if Hitler had won, should the world just get over it? Lincoln was the same sort of tyrant and personally responsible for the deaths of over 800,000 Americans in a war that was unnecessary and unconstitutional. I don't even have a question.
And he was saying that in response to someone telling him, look, the Supreme Court has decided marriage is, you know, gay marriage is legal. Why don't you just get on and move, get over it and move on? And that's what his response was to. I don't think my explaining that makes what he said any more understandable.
But when I read it, I didn't know whether it was 1944 or 1864. Look, I was a little confused by that.
As an African American whose ancestors had a very big stake in that war and Lincoln's actions, you know, I think it's ridiculous. I don't know if he even thought before he made that statement.
Well, plus, the war was started – a little history lesson, Mr. Pittman. The war was started by South Carolina when they fired on Fort Sumter. Lincoln didn't start the war.
Not only did he not start the war at Fort Sumter, but before he was inaugurated, there were already moves to secede from the Union. It wasn't – Lincoln clearly was not looking for a war.
Can I bring up something too that's fascinating here? A couple of things. This Facebook post is just. I believe it's taken down now. I went to try to see if there were any more reaction to it this morning.
I tweeted a screenshot.
I've seen it. I've seen it. But it's a couple of things. First of all, the get over it and the Hitler response, that at least was linear. I'm not going to agree with it, but it was clear linear. The jump to Abraham Lincoln came out of nowhere. He just clearly had something he wanted to say about Abe Lincoln. And the two things that are hilarious to me about this, and this is a disturbing – I'm not laughing at what he said. It is disturbing. But first of all, this is interesting to have somebody, you know, criticize the first Republican president in such a crazy way. And second of all, he even got the numbers wrong. And I doubted it. I was like, oh, maybe I better check civilian casualty everything. 800,000 people did not die in the Civil War. 620,000 soldiers, around 50,000 civilians. So he felt the need to conflate the number or was simply misinformed. I'll let you decide.
Well, in all fairness, some historians have fairly recently increase their estimate of the number of people who did die. I've not read 800. I think I've read maybe up to 700 and some thousand.
I think it's counting the civilians.
I can't believe we're spending time talking about
that. Well, look,
I just think it's fascinating that
it's important that we kind of put some context around who Larry Pittman is in the Republican House caucus, because that's something that's gone missing. And you know, when Time magazine does the article, they just say House Republican, you know, and it's painting all the House Republican lawmakers with this broad brush. Larry Pittman is to the extreme right, even within the House Republican caucus. Him and one of his colleagues who filed the gay marriage bill this week, Michael Speciale from New Bern, I think they call themselves the House Freedom Caucus. I think they're the only two in North Carolina that, you know, that meet in this quote unquote caucus. But they are extreme and conservative even within their party. But and so when they file these bills and say these things that paints all North Carolina Republicans like this, a lot of the North Carolina Republicans, even the ones who've said some other crazy stuff, kind of scratch their head and go, oh, boy. So,
And this is a guy who earlier this year, I think it was February, also filed a bill that would change North Carolina's constitution in order to allow it to secede from the union.
Yes. I think both of them, both the two men that I just said, and they have a history of filing bills that are never going to get heard, that are outside of the mainstream. And so, you know, I think it's important that we put Larry Pittman in a little bit of context for people.
And I think the normal process would have been to send it to the Rules Committee quietly, you know, which is sort of like your childhood dog going off to the farm. You know, it's never coming back. But in this case, I think Tim Moore stepped up to specifically say, in case you don't understand, this is going nowhere, it's dead. And I think that's part of this whole national reputation thing in the aftermath of a thing that I'm not going to name because we've so far gotten almost through the show without saying that phrase that has its own little musical lead-in, but
don't do it.
I'm not going to say it.
No,
the bill
whose
name shall not be.
Yes. and part of this, I think, was, and I'll go ahead and say because I'm part of that problem as the media, but part of this is the media should know better than to seize on this. The local Raleigh press corps should know better than to blow this out of proportion and say, look, the Republicans filed this bill. We all knew this bill wasn't going anywhere.
All right, then let's stop talking about it. But they did do something this week. Some state's lawmakers now want to look at how to split North Carolina school systems into smaller districts, which would potentially break up CMS and Wake County schools, which are the largest districts in the state. Bill Brawley and John Bradford, both from Mecklenburg County, both Republicans, introduced this. Where is this coming from?
Well, the bill says that districts that have been merged, which is virtually all of them at some point, in 1960, the Mecklenburg County school system and the Charlotte City schools merged, there would be a study commission to decide whether and how they might be unmerged or separated. And this is coming from, you know, you had a very rural school system and a city school system, all of it majority white. They merged city and county long before they merged black and white school systems. Now you have in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools a countywide 147,000 students, only 29% of them white. But most of those white students are in the suburbs, and the demographic changes are not 100% of what's going on, but it is clearly part of what is when this is discussed. Basically, people get frustrated with CMS, often for good reasons. Overcrowded schools, uncertainty about student assignment, and the suburbs tend to be the ones who start saying, wouldn't it be nice if we had a north suburban or a south suburban school system?
And one of the sponsors mentioned that a lot of their constituents are moving here from other places in the country that have significantly smaller school districts. One place would be New Jersey, where each little township has its own elementary, junior high, high school, and that's the district.
Right, but then the superintendent is almost like a principal
right.
here.
Yeah.
And that is, they talked about economies and diseconomies of scale. I think that's, if there were a study commission, maybe that's one of the things they would look at, not only the process they're talking about, would there be a petition, would there be a referendum, but one wonders if they would look at financially how that would work, because would you need now three or four superintendents for Mecklenburg County?
Well, and you would also need something else, too. If you look at a lot of these other school systems where they have these, in essence, comparatively, micro districts, a lot of them have either assessment powers or taxing powers.
Right.
So what would you do with those here in North Carolina?
And I was going to go there. I lived in New Jersey for a while, and I can tell you that I paid more in property taxes in a month than we pay here in a, you know, for an entire right. year to operate those small schools. Independent school districts.
I'm going to get to a story that we've been trying to get to now for 3 weeks. And now that Nick is here along with Tom for several years now, craft beer makers have been asking for North Carolina's beer distribution laws to be changed. They were small businesses with relatively small reach, but that's beginning to change now significantly. What's the problem with current regulations as far as the craft beer makers are concerned?
Well, they can only make up to 24,999 barrels of beer a year and be able to sell that themselves.
There's a song in that.
Yes, there is. My news director said the same thing this week.
And it might be on Charlotte Squawks. We never know.
But so three breweries in the state, including Old Mecklenburg and Noda Brewing here in Charlotte, are about to hit that cap. And they want to continue to be able to sell their own beer without having to hire a third-party distributor.
They were on the show about a year ago talking about this very thing. When you get above 25,000 barrels per year, you have to farm out your distribution. You lose control of your own product. Yep. Why? Why aren't they just delivering your product? Why are they – what kind of control are you ceding?
They get to market it. They get to market it. They get to sell it. They help set the rates. They collect excise taxes. The distribution system was actually created after Prohibition ended as an additional check on – basically, at least according to the beer distributors and the wine distributors, as a way to stop Big Bad Brewery from forcing local market or local restaurant to only take their product. That's how they pitch it. But in reality, what it is there really is a loss of brand. And there's also a job component from both sides. If you look at the distributors, if they don't keep control of, you know, what is in essence a small version of a monopoly, then
– big version of monopoly.
Yeah, that's fair. Then they have to, you know, fire or lay off staff. The breweries who haven't hit this cap
they're still distributing Bud Light.
I'm saying what they say.
Okay. The distributors say this will hurt our business, but I mean,
I actually do. It will hurt their business because more people, you know, the percentage of beer consumption in North Carolina has remained relatively stable for a whole lot of time.
And people are shifting,
shifting tastes. Okay. And what you end up with though is the beer smackdown that's going on in Raleigh right now is fascinating, and it's really interesting. And here's the latest twist. The latest twist is the people who are supporting the distributors are saying, hey, are breweries paying all of their excise taxes? Which are basically, if you sell something, you have to...
They're not just saying that. They're saying they're not paying all of their excise taxes.
Well, they're saying it through a strange audit form where they may or may not. There's lots of discussion on this, but the state right now doesn't seem to be able to tell you whether or not they are meaningfully actually paying their taxes. And that may be what holds up this bill, period.
Well, we'll stay tuned.
We could have a whole conversation.
So we'll have an empty glass waiting for the resolution of this, I suppose. Nick Oxner here from WBTV News, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all.